Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Broadcast Blue. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard, and I'm glad you've joined me today for this episode of Broadcast Blue, where we bring you the latest developments in the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is our third audio episode, so we're getting into something of a rhythm here. Just as a reminder, the weekly audio podcasts are topical in nature, and the weekly video podcasts are what we call our case of the week. We showcase a very recent case of the week. The topic of this week's audio podcast is accessing stored communications in criminal investigations. And our focus, of course, will have to be on the Stored Communications Act, which is Chapter 121 of Title 18, which is found in sections 2701 through 2712. As always, I need to throw in the little legal disclaimer up front, and that this is purely an academic discussion for academic purposes only. And the discussion that takes place during this podcast is neither offered as nor should be construed as legal advice. There we go. Got that little legal disclaimer out of the way. That's what happens when you stick an attorney in front of a microphone for a podcast. Like I said before, our topic today is the Stored Communications Act. But before I start talking about accessing stored communications in criminal investigations, let me give you just a little bit of a background. Two different things I want to talk about here. First, I want to talk a little bit about the hierarchy of the law. Now, I know this is something of common sense to a lot of people. Others might not really think about it. They might kind of know it, but not really know why. But let me just kind of explain something that's fundamental to the discussion that's going to come here a little bit later. First, the concept or notion of hierarchy of the law is especially with respect to the United States Constitution and federal and sometimes even state statutes. What you need to understand going into this is that the Constitution provides a baseline of protection for people from certain types of government action to the extent it applies at all. Sometimes there's the action that is being taken isn't constitutional in nature, and it doesn't trigger constitutional scrutiny. For example, if a certain act by a law enforcement officer does not constitute a search under the Fourth Amendment, then it doesn't have to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, which means you don't have to have a warrant or a judicially recognized exception. So if the Fourth Amendment is applicable, or if the Constitution generally is applicable, that is going to establish a baseline of protection that the people have. Congress is always free to raise the bar and provide people with more protection than what the Constitution affords. So if the Constitution isn't applicable at all, Congress can create a statute that, for example, making something a criminal act that would not necessarily be an unconstitutional act. They can raise the bar. They can also raise the bar on something that is constitutional in nature. They can have something where it might be a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and then Congress can say, but we're going to make it criminal as well, and they can make it more difficult to allow for law enforcement to do that. We're going to see that in a couple places at play today in this podcast as well. So it's important to understand that from the beginning, how through statute the bar can be raised. And of course, states can raise the bar even higher. They can give their citizens even more protection than what the Constitution or federal statute might provide. They can always provide more protection, but never less. And that's the whole concept of this hierarchy of the law. I also want to point out that intercepting communications is always something that we as Americans have been kind of sensitive about. It's always something that's we've always been it's always been on the back of our American psyche, this whole concept of the government eavesdropping and intercepting conversations without you knowing it, or communications and listening in. And it goes all the way back, and there's some really good cases that you've heard of before, might not have understood the ramifications of them. If you've ever been a student of mine or listened to enough of my webinars or podcasts or taken any of the e-learning online that we offer, You might have heard something about the Olmstead case. You probably heard about Roy Olmstead, that Seattle Police Department, the Seattle police officer turned bootlegger back during the Prohibition era in the Roaring Twenties. Well, the whole thing with the Olmstead decision, as you might recall, the Supreme Court, using the old school definition of what constituted a search under the Fourth Amendment back then, the Supreme Court stated that it was not a search under the Fourth Amendment for federal agents to tap the phone lines, the wiretap the lines to listen in on the conversations that Mr. Olmstead was having. It was a 5-4 decision. It was very close. But in that decision, they actually invited Congress and said, well, you know, if just because we're saying this isn't a Fourth Amendment issue doesn't mean that you can't raise the bar and prohibit it. And that's exactly what happened. About 6 years after the Olmstead decision, the Communications Act of 1934 was created. And this is a massive act, page after page after page. It did a lot of things. It created the Federal Communications Commission in order to regulate wire and radio communications, and all these wire communications obviously being the telephone back then in the day. It made it criminal. In addition to creating the Federal Communications Commission, it also made it criminal to tap a telephone wire. It made it a criminal act to tap a telephone line. And there was no exception for law enforcement. So the 1934 statute here, the Communications Act of 1934, prohibited the police officers from doing, after the act was created, from what they were able to do because the court had determined in Olmstead that it was not a Fourth Amendment issue. So they raised the bar. Supreme Court said, hey, this isn't a Fourth Amendment issue. They raised the bar and said, well, we're going to make it a criminal act. And they provided people with protection against that. Okay. Now, another very famous decision, the Katz decision, Katz versus United States, back in 1967, it led to the codification of the concept of oral communications in which people have a reasonable expectation of privacy, what I often abbreviate as an REP communication. You might recall in the Katz decision back there on Sunset Strip in Los Angeles, placing the recording device, the microphone, in the phone booth so they could hear what Mr. Katz was saying. He was a bookie, and he's making these telephone calls to Boston and to Miami. And they're listening. They're recording what he's saying. They didn't tap the phone line because they couldn't, because of that 1934 Communications Act statute that made it criminal to tap the line. That was still in effect 30 years later, in the mid-60s. So in the Katz decision, the court created this concept and said it's a Fourth Amendment issue. It's a search under the Fourth Amendment. And Katz radically expanded the definition of a search under the Fourth Amendment, and it to include this intercept of REP oral communications. Well, Congress liked what the Supreme Court did. You know, they liked this whole concept of this reasonable expectation of privacy in the Katz decision. And so when they passed the Omnibus Safe Streets Crime and Control Act of 1968, and this was a massive omnibus bill, in Title III of this particular act, they codified, they took the Supreme Court and Katz, and they gave people more protection. They raised the bar from the constitutional protection the Supreme Court had given on the intercept of oral communications. They repeal the provisions of the Communications Act of 34 that make it criminal to wiretap, and now they're going to protect through statute two different types of intercepts of communication. They're going to protect the wire from wiretaps, which is what they did in 34, but they're going to add another category of communications that are protected from intercept, and that is these oral communications in which people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So if you, after 1968, if you use a device to intercept voice communications that people are having, then it is going to be criminal. They raise that bar. They combined it with wiretap. So as of 1968, we have two of these protected categories of communication intercept. And you're probably wondering to yourself right now, self, he said we were going to talk about stored communications, and all he's been talking about is intercepting communications. But it's important that you have this baseline, that you understand where it was that we came from. Because you see, communications were transmitted and not stored anywhere in the 1960s. It wasn't a Southern Bell, or if you were down in the South here, or if you Pacific Bell or any of the baby bells, if you had a telephone service in the 60s, it was with a bell, because before the bells were all broken up. And they didn't record conversations. They didn't record any conversations. It wasn't something that they routinely kept. In fact, if you made a local call, they didn't even store what number you were dialing, because unlimited local calls were free as a part of the bell service. You had to, if you were getting into long distance, you had, now you were looking at AT&T. So it wasn't stored. Communications were transmitted, but not stored anywhere in 1960s technology. By a service provider. But that was soon to change. And if you're 50-some-year-old like I am, you understand you've lived through the revolution from tube technology of the 1960s to what they called solid-state circuitry with transistors and stuff instead of tubes in the 70s, the solid-state technology, to microchips and large-scale integration and very large-scale microchip integration in the 80s, and then the advances that have taken place since then. But when you get up to the 80s, now you're in the 80s with microchips, and you have these technological advances. These technological advances created new methods of communicating electronically that allowed for new ways to transmit communications, but it also created situation where you had these stored communications. Way back in the day, when before there was really the internet, we had the ability to communicate. One machine could communicate, computers could communicate with each other directly through modems and dialing. One machine would dial another machine. There were bulletin boards where you would actually call up a bulletin board and you could exchange information and communicate through this bulletin board. And then we had the America Online and the Prodigy and the CompuServe boom, where for the very first time, people started having email. And email became a way of communicating versus what we would call snail mail. And we have these electronic communication service providers like AOL and CompuServe and Prodigy that were providing this service. And you would pay for AOL and you would have your AOL.com email address, and it would tell you, you've got mail, and you would do all that, you know, that stuff back in the 80s. It was a paradigm shift, wasn't it? It was a change in the way that we do things. And as a result of these technological advances, as a result of the way things were going with these stored electronic communications and different types of communicating in real time electronically, Congress passed the Electronics Communication Privacy Act of 1986. This is abbreviated as the ECPA, and Congress specifically created this act to address issues in communications privacy that were created as a result of these technological advances. So to their credit, they're trying to stay on top of these huge changes that are taking place in the way that people communicate. Now, there's three different titles to the ECPA. Title I of the ECPA added a third category. And remember, wire and oral communications were already protected under T3 of the 1968 Omnibus Act, right? T3 is already protecting wire and oral communications, but Title I of the ECPA expanded that to include yet a third category of communications, and that would be electronic communications, which was kind of a catch-all. If people are communicating real-time, then it fits in that category. If it's not wire, it's not oral, and they're communicating, it is electronic communications. Of course, that's a very broad net, and you're going to catch a lot of dolphin in that tuna net. So they put in a whole bunch of exceptions, things that didn't count for the purposes of the act for electronic communications. But it would include people who were communicating in a way real time other than by voice. And so to intercept a text message would be an electronic communication intercept. To intercept an email in transit would be an electronic communication intercept. To intercept a fax as it was being faxed from one number to another, would be an electronic communications intercept. So it set down these requirements for what it would take in order for to allow law enforcement to do this. And since it was a statute and it raised the bar, it created this whole concept of, you know, this order. It actually added to the concept of the wiretap order that was created in 1968. And if you've ever got a T3 order, you know that there's a lot more to it than a search warrant application. It's a lot more difficult to get a wiretap order than it is to get a search warrant. And we'll save the specifics of that for another day. But most folks understand and appreciate that significance already. Now, Title One added another type of a category for communications intercept protection. Title Three, the pen and trap statute. Title Three of the ECPA prohibits the use of pen registers and or trap and trace devices to intercept communication addressing or routing or signaling information without a court order. And the court order is actually created under Title III of the ECPA. And what you have to understand is that the Supreme Court had said that people had no privacy. It wasn't reasonable to expect privacy in this communication routing information or addressing information, non-communicative content. You know, whenever you call someone, you're going to have to dial a number. Well, what you say on the telephone call is protected, right, under Title I of the ECPA, but the number that you dial is not. And the Supreme Court had said that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the numbers that you dial or the numbers dialing you because you freely give that information to a third party. And this kind of invoked the third party doctrine. And Title III, so what Title III of the ECPA did was basically raise the bar, because without Title III of the ECPA, law enforcement wouldn't have to do anything in order to put a pin and trap on a telephone account, or as it was extended to email accounts. You can pin and trap email accounts as well. So to determine the addressing information, any type of communication that is routed and addressed, the addressing information will be protected under Title III of the ECPA, which requires a pen and trap order. Since it wasn't a Fourth Amendment issue, they were raising the bar from nothing, which means it's not very hard to get. It's not like getting a warrant. It's the requirements are much less. It's the probable cause is not the standard, and obtaining a PRTT order is not incredibly difficult to do. But it's something. It's something that you have to do because Congress raised the bar with Title III. Now, it's Title II. Titles 1 and 3 deal with intercepts. One is intercepting communications, and the other is addressing communication addressing information. But Title 2 of the ECPA is known as the Stored Communications Act. And Title 2 of the ECPA, otherwise called the SCA for Stored Communications Act, protects communications and communication routing information that's held in electronic storage with electronic communication service providers. So now the statute recognized that we had a situation now to where communications were actually being stored because they were not voice communications going over a telephone line. It's an email. It's like you've got an email that's being sent through an email service provider, and you want to see the actual content of this stored email. And you can also have it's possible to have stored text messages that aren't in transit anymore. They've been delivered from one point to the other, and now they're sitting there in storage. But with this whole concept of emails and how what are we going to do about this stored information? And for stored historical stuff, we're not talking intercepts real time. We're talking things that have been stored. For the stored electronics communication, the Stored Communications Act, or the SCA, broke the types of information that would be stored into three discrete categories. You have basic subscriber information, transactional information, and then communications, the actual communicative content. communications content. And the SCA breaks what you find with these stored, with this electronic communication service providers, the types of information into these three categories. And depending on which category you're looking for, the type of information you're looking for, what it's going to take to get it. Now, with basic subscriber information, you can get to basic subscriber information with nothing more than just a subpoena. Now, actually, the statute didn't do anything you couldn't do already, right? Because you could already use a subpoena without the statute because of the third-party doctrine to get this type of information. So let's say you're doing a child pornography investigation and you have dirtyperv401 at yahoo.com and you want to know who dirtyperv401 is. At least you want to know what the information that was used to create the account with Yahoo is. So you would go to them with a subpoena and say, tell us this information that this person used to create this account here with you at Yahoo. What name did they give you? What address did they give you? What telephone number? What payment method? There was a payment involved in order to create the account. How did they pay you? That type of basic subscriber information. Who is this person? An email address is like an alias. Well, who is this an alias for? What type of basic subscriber information do you have? You can get this with a subpoena. And so they really didn't raise the bar or anything on that. Now, with transactional information, it's a little bit different. Transactional information is information on how a person interacts and transacts through their specific account. So for an email, a specific email address, who is it that they are emailing? What are the email addresses of the people that they are emailing, to whom they're sending email? And what are the email addresses of people, the people who are emailing them? And so if you have a specific target of investigation and you want to know what are the email addresses that this person's sending to this person, without the Stored Communications Act, you would have been able to get to that with just a subpoena because it's under the third-party doctrine. It's not protected. So what Congress did with the Stored Communications Act was raise the bar on this transactional information, information that you otherwise would have been able to get to with a subpoena under the statute. When they raised the bar, they said, no, we're going to require that you have a 2703D court order in order to get this. And 2703D, and 2703 is one of the sections within the Stored Communications Act. And it makes it harder than just with a subpoena. It raises the bar a little bit. Without the statute, you could have got it with a subpoena, but they've raised the bar. So in order, under the statute, in order to get to this transactional information, you have to get a court order under the statute, a 2703D order, in order to get to this transactional information. Transactional information includes the email addresses that a person sends email to, the email addresses that send them to them, the websites that are visited, the history, browser history, and it also includes cell site connection information. Whenever a cell phone connects with a tower, when you use your phone, for example, the phone company doesn't only know, your provider doesn't only know what number you've dialed, which would be communications routing information, wouldn't it? It would be something that would be protected under this. But it also includes which tower you're connected to. What tower was this person connected to? And if you know what tower a cell phone's connected to, you kind of get a feel for the location, where this thing was generally located. Historically, you can tell that. Well, this, what we often refer to as cell site location information, or CSLI, this cell site location information, a cell site connection information, is transactional information. And so you can get to that with a 2703D order. Remember, before the Stored Communications Act, you could have got to this with just a subpoena. So Congress was raising the bar and affording this type of transactional information more protection than it would otherwise be covered without the statute in place. Which is kind of interesting. It brings us to a very current case. We've got the Carpenter versus United States case. It's in front of the Supreme Court this month. I think oral arguments are going to be this week or the week coming up. We've got oral arguments about to happen any time now. And A very interesting case. In this case, the defendant in the case, Carpenter, is arguing that things have changed. Our society has changed, and that now that there you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in your cell site location information, whereas you might not before, 15, 20 years ago, because of the way telephones have changed, the way everything's changed, now we have an expectation of privacy in the cell site location information, notwithstanding the fact we freely give it to a third party, especially a third party commercial vendor. And so what they're basically asking the court to do is afford REP to this reasonable expectation of privacy to the cell site location information such that it would be a Fourth Amendment event in order to get to cell site location information. If it is protected under the Fourth Amendment, then it's going to require a warrant, which is more than a 2703D order. So they're, through this case, the defendant is trying to raise the bar even higher, and with arguments that harken all the way back to January of 2012 in Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion in United States versus Jones, and the whole concept of the third-party doctrine and REP and digital data, just given the huge volume of digital data that exists out there, whether or not the third-party doctrine should be abrogated or modified to some extent when it comes to the concept of digital data. The court's going to hear it. We'll see what happens. It's going to be a very interesting case on a lot of fronts. Absolutely guarantee when the Carpenter decision's issued, it's going to be it's going to be the video case of the week for right here on Broadcast Blue. So stand by for more information on that. Let's see where that transactional information's going and where cell site location information as categorized as transactional information, how that's going to be affected. We've already had case law that has had a significant impact on the Stored Communications Act, and that leads to the third category of stored communications, which is the actual content itself. So you've got email, right? You've got this person, dirtypur401 at yahoo.com, and you want to know who it is. And you want to find out, that's your basic subscriber information. Now you want to find out who is he emailing and who's emailing him and what sites have he visited, has he visited. Now you're talking about transactional information in the 2703D order. But now you want to actually read the emails that he's sending and that he's received. You're looking at the actual email content. That includes subject line and attachment names. And that is protected. That is a Fourth Amendment issue under the Stored Communications Act. You need a warrant in order to get to that. There's a little bit of a fly in the ointment when it comes to this particular provision of the Stored Communications Act, because Congress actually said that if an email is opened and then saved, or if an email is received but left unopened for 180 days, that there's a diminished expectation of privacy in that. And so you don't have to have a warrant to get to opened emails or unopened emails greater than 180 days. You can just get to that with a subpoena. That's what the Stored Communication Act actually says. But about 7 years ago in a really significant case, United States versus Warshak, which you can find at 631 Fed 3rd 266, the 2010 decision from the Sixth Circuit. What the Sixth Circuit said was fundamentally, hey, look, Congress, it's not your job to determine where a person has REP and where they don't. Whether or not there's a reasonable expectation of privacy, though, you're talking about the CATS definition of a search, and that is for the courts to decide. And ultimately the Supreme Court. The courts determine where it's reasonable for a person to have privacy, expect privacy, and where they're not. And so you can't do this through statute. And, oh, by the way, your statute's wrong, because you had stated in the statute, and talking to Congress, right, the statute says that you can get to that, that there's diminished REP, so you should be able to get to this stuff. The opened emails are 100 – unopened emails greater than 180 days old, that you can get to this because there's no REP in it, and that's not true. Well, as we find, the court found that there was just as much REP in an opened email that was kept as there was in an unopened email that had just been received, and that it wasn't the province of Congress in order to make this determination. And so they held that that portion of the Stored Communications Act that allows to access to any email content with anything less than a warrant is unconstitutional. You've lowered the bar with statute, and you cannot do that. You can only raise the bar. And so they held that it was unconstitutional. And through DOJ policy, DOJ fundamentally concurred with that concept. And so for the last 7 years, we've already had a part of the SCA that had a hole blown in it with the Warshak case. And it might be that we're about to have another section that's transactional information with Carpenter. We're just going to kind of have to see what happens. So that's fundamentally accessing stored communications. You've always got to be asking yourself, am I trying to get to stored communications? And if you are, you know you have to have a warrant. If are you trying to get to some type of transactional information? Are you trying to find out who the person is that's sending some type of communication? Are you trying to figure out, you know, what's the routing address for this particular communications device? You're trying to if you're ever trying to determine what the communication routing information is for some communications, then you're looking at transactional information, and you're going to need a 2703D order to do something like that. If you're looking for the stored stuff, if you're looking to actually intercept addressing communication information, now you're under Title III of the ECPA, and you're going to need a PRTT order, a pen and trap order. And very, very important to understand how these points work together, which is why I talked about both of them. So I've gone out of 30 minutes now. I want to keep these things to half an hour. So Warshak, we've already know with as a result of the Warshak decision, the SCA doesn't quite operate the way it's written on paper. And depending on what happens in the Carpenter case, it might even become more diluted. So you got to stay tuned and see what's going on. Stored communications can be very important information in criminal investigations, but you have to know how to get to it properly. Not only could it lead to the exclusionary rule, it could also lead to criminal charges. You've got to follow the law here when it comes to accessing stored communications and obviously intercepting communications as well. Well, that's it for this edition of Broadcast Blue. Just as a quick footnote, I want to let you know that starting this January, I'll be conducting Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinars on our own Adobe Connect platform. So just stay tuned. A little bit of a teaser there. Stay tuned for more information on that. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Broadcast Blue. Please help spread the word to other local, state, federal, and tribal law enforcement officers across the country. You can subscribe at www.broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address. Or look up Broadcast Blue on iTunes or Google Play in the podcast search there. If you have any recommendations or suggestions or compliments or feedback of any kind, please feel free to drop me a note at bruce@broadcast.blue. Thank you very much for what you do. And until next time, this is Bruce Allen Barnard signing off.